Welcome to VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, reports of a major attack by al-Shabaab militants on a military base in Somalia. We'll hear about the U.S. filing terror charges against an American IS suspect. The American Islamic community remembers boxing champ and humanitarian Muhammad Ali. And a documentary that takes a different look at former state star football player O.J. Simpson.
He's this pioneering commercial pitchman as a black athlete before he ever played a down in the NFL. And that two-year period of how someone sort of flips like that was fascinating to me.
It's on International Edition. There are conflicting reports about what is going on in Somalia today. The African Union Force says soldiers have killed many al-Shabaab militants, but there are also other reports about how many people were involved. Joining us here in the studio is reporter Abdulaziz Osman, who's been getting information on this by talking to the AU force and the Somali security minister, among others. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
What have you found out?
So far, we have actually found out there are conflicting reports, as you said. The Somali government is telling us one account, and AU is telling us a different account. We spoke to the Somali security minister, Abdirazak Omar Mohamed, who just told us that 240 al-Shabaab fighters were killed and 9 Ethiopian forces were killed in the Helgen attack. And the Ethiopian embassy in Mogadishu, who we have spoken to, said that 120 al-Shabaab fighters were killed. And also AMISOM spokesperson, who we spoke to, also said 110 al-Shabaab fighters were killed. So there is a conflicting reports on the death toll. So,
could you tell us about this battle? What happened?
What happened is that the al-Shabaab group, the al-Shabaab fighters, early in the morning launched 2 massive attacks on the Ethiopian military base in the village of Helgen in central Somalia. So according to the residents in Helgen, they said the first attack the militant attack, both a Ethiopian military base and Somali military base in the Helgen village. So according to the residents who we spoke to said both attack actually lasted 2 hours, and there was a heavy gun battle between the al-Shabaab and the Ethiopian forces.
Tell us a little bit of the background to this story. What is the situation in Somalia there?
It depends on where you look at Somalia. In certain Somali area, in the northern Somaliland, it's restive, and on the Puntland region is another quiet, and there's a peace and tranquility. But in the central and southern Somalia, where Somali militant group is active, is where the problem is. So still there is some conflict, war, and fighting that often happen in that area.
This even though the African Union has been stationed in there since 2007.
Yes, they have been. Somalia has more than 22,000 from African Union. So they are stationed in the main cities like the capital in the southern city of Kismayo, another city, Baidabo, and the other main cities in southern and central Somalia. They have actually managed to help the weak government in Somalia to restore some kind of peace in Somalia, but still the militant group is posing a threat to the government and to also AMISOM, African Union troops.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky has joined me here at the anchor's desk, and he's going to talk to us about a little visit today. Mr. Bernie Sanders, one of the Democratic candidates for president, has gone to the White House and had a talking to with the president, President Obama.
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders, of course, his goal is still to get to the White House, but get there, you know, January 20th, 2017,
right,
on Inauguration Day.
And
in fact, he didn't drop out of the race today. There was a lot of speculation on social media that he might after this White House meeting. But he said he's in the race still. However, he did say that he's going to work with Hillary Clinton to stop Donald Trump, that the ultimate goal is to defeat Donald Trump. So there's a lot of questions and speculation on social media. Is this the beginning of the end of his campaign? Is he trying to roll it down? He said he does want to compete and will compete in the primaries in the District of Columbia here. And
that
takes place.
That's the last one.
And it's the last one of the primary season. It takes place this upcoming Tuesday. So there's some questions, too, maybe after that race that he, on the day after, will drop out. But all this speculation, not many answers, just a lot of people wondering on social media what this means, what's going forward, especially now that Hillary Clinton, after all of the major contests, is the presumptive nominee.
And you mentioned there's been a lot of hacking on Twitter and going on.
Yeah, so we've talked about this over the past couple days, the people like Mark Zuckerberg, Katy Perry, the National Football League here in the United States, all of their Twitter accounts have been hacked in various ways, people either guessing passwords or breaking in. And now there's this report that hackers allegedly have accessed over 32 million Twitter passwords, and they're selling them on the dark web.
Mine's not one of them, is it? Could you check that and see if mine's in there?
I certainly hope yours and mine, I hope they're not on that list. But for our listeners out there, you may want to change your password.
Yeah.
Now, Doug Bernard, who does our cybersecurity, he and I were talking about this and saying, well, it may just be kind of a ruse that these guys are saying they have these passwords, but they don't. But in this age when this could easily happen, it's always good to update your password and make sure, like Mark Zuckerberg, it's not da, da, da. Maybe throw some numbers and symbols in there, some uppercase letters, make it a little more complex.
It's like brush your teeth and change your password.
Brush your teeth and change your password. There we go.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
In the news, militants have attacked a base in central Somalia with car bombs and gunfire. Israel suspends Palestinian travel permits following a Tel Aviv shooting. Two separate car bombs explode in Iraq's capital today. Eritreans say Italy has the wrong man in a migrant smuggling case. Thousands gather to honor former boxer Muhammad Ali. News, feature reports, and more are at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency, or ESA, says they are now very confident of their plans to build a space observatory to detect and observe gravitational waves. Their enthusiasm is based on what they say is the extraordinary performance of its LISA Pathfinder mission. ESA's proposed Evolved Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, or ELISA, mission to measure gravitational waves in space would be made up of one mother and two daughter spacecrafts that will orbit the Sun in a triangular configuration. Each spacecraft would be separated by a distance of 1,000,000 kilometers and will be connected to each other by laser beams to form the arms of a highly precise laser interferometer. Any incoming gravitational waves would be detected by this interferometer by monitoring for any changes in the distance between its lengthy laser arms. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States is filing terrorism charges against an American citizen who first made headlines when he was detained in northern Iraq. Our national correspondent Jeff Selden is following the story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Jeff.
Good to be here.
Thank you. What can you tell us about this case?
Well, this is a case that gained a lot of attention, a lot of notoriety. It's the case of 26-year-old Muhammad Jamal Kawais, who's from Alexandria, Virginia. His parents are of Palestinian descent, but have lived in this country since 1988. A nondescript kid who just seemed to be doing what 20-somethings do. And all of a sudden, in December, he left the country. And according to accounts of what he initially told Kurdistan Television, Kurdistan 24 Television, and then later FBI investigators, he left the country in December 2015, went to London, went to Amsterdam, got to Turkey, and then from Turkey crossed his way into Syria, where he joined the Islamic State. And what brought him to the world's attention is that, because he hadn't been on anybody's radar until that point, but then in March of this year, 2016, Kurdish Peshmerga forces began firing on somebody that they saw near the city of Sinjar, northern Iraq, and then this guy surrenders. It turns out it's this American. So Muhammad Jamal Kawais is the first known American to have been captured on the battlefield. Now, the circumstances of his capture, his detention, whatever you want to call it, are also interesting. Initially, he was fired upon, but then he immediately told the Kurds that he was fleeing from Islamic State. He had had a change of heart and that he was trying to get back to Turkey.
Wasn't there a girl involved in this somewhere?
That's very interesting. One of the things he said in the interview that was aired on Kurdistan TV was that he had been in touch with a girl, and he kind of fallen in love. There was implications of a romantic relationship, and that she was the one who had basically made the arrangements for him to get into Syria, to Raqqa, where he officially joined the Islamic State. That's what he told the television station in the one interview he did. It's interesting because in the criminal complaint that's been filed with the court that was unsealed today, there's no mention of a girl. He admits that since 2015, probably the beginning of 2015, he had become interested in the Islamic State because they had established a caliphate, and he started watching videos, and he had seen videos of their operatives carrying out terrorist operations of executing prisoners, including the video where they execute and burn to death the captured Jordanian pilot. And that he decided this was something he wanted to be a part of. He said he was aware of their brutal methods, but he also said they had a caliphate and they did humanitarian work. He said when he got to Turkey, he traveled across the border into Raqqa with four other Islamic State recruits. Foreigners, obviously, but none American. There's no mention of a girl. Whether or not there is a girl now becomes a question. He also admitted to the FBI in some of the interviews he did while in custody in Iraq, that he had said some things during that interview to protect himself. Now, whether he invented the girl or whether there actually was a girl is going to be one of the things that we find out as the case plays itself out in court. Islamic State has been known to use women to lure recruits, but usually the women are said to be at the other end. When you get to the Islamic State, when you get to Raqqa, when you get to Mosul, that's where they are. That's where you'll get the wife. This was an interesting twist. There's a chance now that it may have been invented.
What a kind of defense is he going to have? Has anybody said anything about that yet?
I've talked to his defense attorney who is going to be meeting with Kwais and representing him. A lot of this is difficult because parts of what happened, obviously, Kwais is now an alleged terrorist. He's a terror suspect who has insider knowledge of the workings of the Islamic State. So there are parts of this that are going to be classified, parts that are not going to be classified. So it's going to be a process to figure out what he's saying, how he's saying it. It seems, though, from the criminal complaint, though, he's pretty much admitted that he knew what the Islamic State was about and that he went there to join the Islamic State. Another thing, and part of the reason for the charges being brought, is that he told investigators that when he first came to the Islamic State and he began his indoctrination or his training in Raqqa, in the self-declared caliphate's capital in Syria, that he was asked whether or not he'd be willing to be a suicide bomber for Islamic State, and he said yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeff. I know you'll be on top of this story for us.
Anytime.
Coming up on International Edition, members of the Islamic community remember the greatest, and a fresh look at former athlete O.J. Simpson.
A funeral for boxing heavyweight champion and humanitarian Muhammad Ali is to be held Friday, but today an Islamic funeral prayer was held in his honor in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. Ali was born Cassius Clay, but he converted to Islam and changed his name. On the line with us from Louisville is the National Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Nahad Awad. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What does Muhammad Ali mean to the Islamic community?
Muhammad Ali has inspired so many people, generations of Muslims and people of other faiths. But in particular, to Muslims, he is the embodiment of Islamic principles, values of justice, courage, compassion, mercy, giving. He embodied this and beyond. And his passing is probably the biggest loss for American Muslims. I know he's, of course, the biggest loss to his family and a big loss for America. But I think, in my judgment, the biggest loser is the American Muslim community because they're losing a human face. They're losing someone who defined what Islam and what Muslims are, not only for America, but for the world. So he will be dearly missed. The way he conducted his life, and the way he connected with people, the way he lived a life of community service, even beyond his hardship and despite his disease, is something that we should all think about, Muslims and non-Muslims alike.
We've heard about Islamic State and other extremists, but Ali puts a whole nother face on Islam.
As you said, the exceptional, the very few actors who try to spoil, you know, the image of 1.2 billion people and the faith that has endured deviations like Christianity and Judaism. We should not allow the acts of the few, no matter how loud they are, you know, from veering away from the true fact that, you know, Islam is the religion of peace, Islam is the religion of mercy, and the lives of 1.7 billion people or so is productive, peaceful, you know. So yes, Muhammad Ali denounced these people. He also denounced anti-Muslim bigotry in this country as late as last December, when Donald Trump decided that, or he suggested that Muslims should not be allowed to come to the U.S. I think it will serve his legacy and memory if people think about the beauty of Muhammad Ali's behavior, speech, courage, what he stood for, and Muslims worldwide consider him as a role model.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? The Nexar app, a smartphone app designed to help you avoid bad drivers. An Israeli developer created it to use along with a dash camera to warn drivers of tricky sections of road and reckless drivers. Iran Shear is Nexar's CEO.
It monitors all of the cars around you and tries to get you out of dangerous situations.
Shear says the app is more than just a recording device. It observes and interprets events on the road.
Nexar detected that there was a hard brake, and it automatically captures the events.
Also, data from accidents captured by Nexar can be used by the app to warn drivers about those locations.
If you're coming to an intersection the first time or second time, and then you'll get a warning with some data about like the number of accidents in that intersection.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossheim.
Hot on the heels of the docudrama The People vs. O.J. Simpson, a 7.5-hour documentary looks at the life of former football star O.J. Simpson from his time in San Francisco through his college career at USC to his famous murder trial. International Edition's David Byrd says that in O.J. Made in America, director Ezra Edelman looks at Simpson's life in its cultural context, America in the late 20th century.
If you're a black man in America, you're fighting our war.
Two totally separate worlds.
For us, O.J. was colorless.
Ezra Edelman is an African-American director known for his sports documentaries, including Brooklyn Dodgers, The Ghosts of Flatbush, Magic and Bird, A Courtship of Rivals, and Cutie and the Boxer. Ezra says he set out to do something other than an O.J. Simpson murder trial film. He wanted to look at O.J. Simpson as a cultural icon, a black man in the late 1960s who wanted to be a celebrity. As part of ESPN's 30 for 30 series, Edelman was granted interviews with key players in the Simpson trial, including former LAPD Detective Mark Furman and prosecutor Marcia Clark. The director says he got that access when people learned he was looking to tell a broader story of O.J.'s life in the context of being black in Los Angeles in the latter third of the 20th century.
I have 5 hours, and what I'm interested in is explaining sort of everything that led up to the trial, who O.J. was as a person, sort of getting into his identity from a racial standpoint, his pursuit of celebrity. But also, I want to tell this story about Los Angeles. I want to tell a story about, you know, this sort of dynamic between the black community and the LAPD, and where this sort of tension and this distrust, how it was bred, and how did we arrive at this point in 1994.
The filmmaker conducted 73 interviews and worked through hundreds of hours of archival footage from Simpson's football career, media interviews, the LAPD archives, and the 1994 trial. Edelman says that he wanted people to see more than one side of O.J. Simpson.
and he's just removed from having come from San Francisco and having grown up in public housing and, you know, in a very black world, and all of a sudden he arrives at this lily white place with a lot of wealthy students, conservative elite, and this transformation that happens where 2 years later, yes, he was the star football player and the Heisman Trophy winner and won a national championship, but he's this pioneering commercial pitchman as a black athlete before he ever played a down in the NFL. And that two-year period of how someone sort of flips like that was fascinating to me.
The film also goes through the now famous 1994 murder trial and the not guilty verdict. O.J. Simpson is still serving a 33-year sentence for armed robbery and kidnapping. He will be eligible for parole next year. O.J. Simpson, Made in America, had a brief theatrical run to qualify for Academy Award competition. It will air on U.S. television beginning June 11th. In Washington, I'm David Byrne.
Like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has granted KSH 380 million to Kenyan innovators as part of its Feed the Future Kenya Innovation Engine, or KIE, an effort to reward and improve agriculture-based innovations. To date, more than 57,000 rural households have benefited from KIE-supported innovations and attracted nearly $1.4 million in public and private sector investment. At a launch held May 31st in Nairobi, the agency granted funds to 10 local firms to transform simple agriculture initiatives into valuable projects in Kenya. Such projects have played key roles in improving incomes in individual households, while at the same time reducing poverty levels and improving food security among communities. Following a vetting process, six of these pilot rollout grants have already been awarded, and the Innovation Engine is poised to grant funding and technical assistance to an additional four advanced innovations, said Karen Freeman, the Mission Director, USAID Kenya and East Africa. Kenya Innovation Engine is a five-year program implemented in collaboration with USAID partner Land O'Lakes International Development that identifies, nurtures, and brings to scale innovative private sector-oriented solutions to food security, undernutrition, and poverty. The Innovation Engine collaborates with entrepreneurs who design new concepts, products, and services to maximize their commercial value. The initiative was launched in 2012 with funding from USAID. Kenya Innovation Engine has so far provided seed funding and technical expertise to 22 innovations with a promise of more support for food security and social support initiatives. This initiative has contributed substantively to building the businesses and institutions involved in these areas, said Ms. Freeman. Among the benefits achieved by the initiative, more than 57,000 households reached by new technologies during the proof-of-concept stage, 30,000 farmers made a repeat purchase of the innovation, smallholders have recorded $6.7 million in incremental sales since adopting these innovations, and enterprises created 1,458 jobs at the proof-of-concept innovation testing stage. The United States is proud to work with its partner Kenya to improve agriculture for the benefit of Kenyans and the Africa region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.